This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Today's episode is sponsored by Donors Trust, the tax-friendly way to preserve your charitable giving. More on them later in the show. Just 15% of Americans approve of the job Congress is doing. But why is it broken, and how do we fix it? Those are just two of the questions I asked Justin Amash, the former five-term congressman from Michigan who's currently exploring a Senate run. Elected as part of the Tea Party wave in 2010, Amash helped create the House Freedom Caucus, but became an increasingly lonely, principled voice for limiting the size, scope, and spending of the federal government. After voting to impeach Donald Trump, he resigned from the GOP, became an independent, and joined the Libertarian Party in 2020, making him the only Libertarian to serve in Congress. We talked about the 2024 presidential race and the country's political and cultural polarization that seems to be growing with every passing day. We also talked about how his parents' experiences as a Christian refugee from Palestine and an immigrant from Syria inform his views on foreign policy, entrepreneurship, and American exceptionalism. This Q&A took place on the final day of LibertyCon, the annual event for Students for Liberty that was held recently in Washington, D.C. Here is the Reason interview with Justin Amash.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming out and even coming out for Justin Amash. But let's give it up to him one more time, please. So the topic of this talk, and we're going to veer away from that, but let's start with why is Congress broken? And how do we fix that? And, you know, let's give you a couple minutes on that.
All right. Well, we could take up the whole 30 minutes talking about that if we wanted to. We don't know exactly how Congress got to where it is, but today it is highly centralized, where a few people at the top control everything. And that has a lot of negative consequences for our country. Among them is that the president has an unbelievable amount of power, because the president now only has to negotiate with really a few people. You have to negotiate with the Speaker of the House, you have to negotiate with the Senate Majority Leader, and maybe some of the minority leaders. But it's really a small subset of people that you have to negotiate with. And when that happens, it gives the president so much leverage. So when we talk about things like going to war without authorization, well, as long as the Speaker of the House isn't going to hold the president accountable and the Senate Majority Leader is not going to, the president is just going to do what he wants to do. And when it comes to spending, as long as the president only has to negotiate with a couple people, the president's going to do whatever the president wants to do. So it's super easy in the system for the president to essentially bully Congress and dictate the outcomes. But there's a deeper problem with all of this, which is representative government is supposed to be a discovery process. You elect people to represent you, you send them to Washington, and then the outcomes are supposed to be discovered by these representatives through discussions and debates and the introduction of legislation and amendments. And you're supposed to have lots of votes where you freely, you know, where the votes freely reflect your will representing the people back home. But instead, in Congress today, a few leaders are deciding what the final product is. And then they're even not bringing it to the floor until they know they have the votes. So there's no actual discovery process. And Nancy Pelosi used to brag about this, like she wouldn't bring a bill to the floor unless she knew it was going to pass.
Right.
Which is the opposite of how Congress should work.
So what are some of the ways to kind of decentralize power within Congress? You know, when you were in Congress, you founded the Freedom Caucus, which was supposed to be kind of a redoubt of people who believed in, you know, limited government and libertarian and conservative principles, and actually even some liberal principles, but decentralizing authority. You got kicked out of the Freedom Caucus, right?
Well, I resigned from it.
You were asked to leave, right? It was like the police sirens were coming in. It's like, hey, you know what? I'm going to go, right? But even places like that that were explicitly designed to act as a countervailing force to this unified Congress. So how can that happen? What can you do, or what can somebody do to make that happen?
Well, it does take people with strong will. I think that when we go to vote for our elected officials, when you go to vote for a representative, when you go to vote for a senator, you have to know that that person is willing to stand up to the leadership team. And if that person's not willing to break from the leadership team on a consistent basis, and this doesn't mean they have to, you know, be mean or anything like that.
That's an option.
That's an option.
Yeah.
But they just have to be independent enough where you know they're willing to break from their leadership team. And if they're not willing to do that, it doesn't matter how much they agree with you on the issues, don't vote for them. Because that person's going to sell out. There's no chance they're going to stand up for you when it counts. So I think you need to have people who have a strong will, who are going to go there and actually represent you and are willing to stand up to the leaders.
Yeah. If you are interested in Congressman Amash's commentary on contemporary issues, go to his Substack. You know, it's Justin Amash, and the tagline is: a former congressman spills on Congress and makes the practical case for the principles of liberty. So it's on Substack. It's a great read. And particularly on issues, you mentioned kind of war and things like that, and the War Powers Resolution. It's great stuff. But can you tell us quickly, how did you discover libertarian ideas? And then, you know, you got elected in 2010, which was a wave election. It was the part of the Tea Party reaction to 8 years of Bush more problems, during the financial crisis and the reaction of government to that. Where did you first encounter the ideas of liberty, and how did that motivate you to get into Congress?
Well, the ideas of liberty are something that have been with me since I was a child. It's hard to pinpoint exactly where they came from. I think they came from my parents' immigrant experience, mm-hmm. Coming to the United States. My dad came here as a refugee. And
a refugee from?
From Palestine.
Yeah.
So he was born in Palestine in 1940. And when the State of Israel was created in 1948, he became a refugee. So my mom is a Syrian immigrant. So when my parents came here, they weren't wealthy. My dad was a very poor refugee. I mean, he was so poor that the Palestinians made fun of him. That's really poor. And when he came here, he didn't have much, but he felt he had opportunity. He felt he had a chance to start a new life, a chance to make it, even though he came from a different background from a lot of people, even though, his English wasn't great compared to a lot of people. So he came here and he worked hard and he built a business. And when we were young, he used to tell us that America is the greatest place on earth, where someone can come here as a refugee like he did and start a new life and have the chance to be successful. And it doesn't matter what your background is. It doesn't matter what obstacles you face. You have a chance here. And you don't have that chance in so many places around the world. So for me, I think that's where that spirit of liberty came from. It was from my dad's experience, especially my mom as well, coming here as a young immigrant. And so I was always a little bit, anti-authoritarian as a child. I rebelled against teachers at times. I didn't like arbitrary authority, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
When someone just would make up a rule like, you know, this is the rule, I just say so. Well, tell me why. Like, what's the, you know?
Have you rethought that as a parent?
No. I mean, I let my kids think very freely. Okay. And
as long as they follow the rules.
I don't mind when they are a little bit rebellious.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't hurt for kids to have some independence. I encourage them to challenge their teachers even when they think the teacher's wrong about something. I think that it's a good thing for people to go out there and not just accept everything as it is.
Yeah.
So
You famously, as a congressman, explained all of your votes on Facebook, which is a rare concession by authority to say, okay, this is why I did what I did.
Yeah, and actually, you know, a lot of the people in leadership and in Congress didn't like that I was doing that because I was giving people at home the power to challenge them.
Yeah.
So instead of just being told, like, this is the way it is, now I was revealing what was going on.
You grew up in Michigan. You went to University of Michigan as an undergrad and for law school. Was it there that you started coming across names like Hayek and Mises and, you know, Friedman, Rand, Rothbard, or whoever?
Not really, no. Yeah. You know, my background's in economics. My degree's in economics. And thank you.
People love economics out there.
There's at least one person with an economics
degree. Hey, has anybody here ever been part of economics?
Anyone from economics here?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, speak slower.
And I did well in economics at Michigan, but we sure didn't study Austrian economics.
Right.
We didn't study Hayek.
Yeah.
I think he might have been mentioned in one class. Very briefly, he was mentioned. There was like one day where he was mentioned. But I'd say that what happened is, as I went through my economics degree and then I got a law degree at Michigan as well, I started to realize that I had a lot of differences from other people who were otherwise aligned with me. You know, I was a Republican. I aligned with them on a lot of things, but there were a number of issues where we didn't align. Some of the foreign policy issues, but certainly a lot of civil liberties issues. Mm-hmm. And I started to wonder, like, what am I?
Yeah.
What, you know, what's going on here? I just thought of myself as a Republican, and I would read the platform and, you know, hear what they're saying. They believe in limited government and economic freedom and individual liberty. But when push came to shove on a lot of issues, they didn't believe those things. You know, they'd say they believe those things, but they didn't. So, and I've told this story before, I just typed some of my views into a Google search. Mm-hmm. And up popped Hayek's Wikipedia page. Mm. So, and literally it was like the top thing on Google. So I clicked on that, started reading about him. And I was already in my mid-20s at this time, you know, and I was like, yes, mm-hmm. this is what I believe.
And do you think that full view of individual liberty, not just in the economic sphere, but in everything else, that's informed by your parents' experience and also they're running a business. But, you know, it is interesting because you would have been coming of age during a time when the Republicans were ascendant. But they were kind of the war party. And, you know, we were told after 9/11 that you should not speak freely. That was kind of a problem, right?
Yeah, sure. And throughout my life, I've believed freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of expression. These are critical values. Maybe they're the essence of everything that makes this country work. You know, the idea that we come from a lot of places. There's an incredible amount of diversity in the United States. I think diversity is always treated or often treated like a bad word these days. But it's a blessing to our country that we have people who come from so many backgrounds. And actually, the principle of liberty is about utilizing that diversity. You know, it's in centrally planned systems where diversity is not utilized, where someone at the top dictates to everyone else and doesn't take advantage of any of the diversity. They say, no, a few of us at the top, we know everything. It doesn't matter. All of your backgrounds, all of your skills, all of your talents, that doesn't matter. What matters is we've got a few people in a room somewhere and they're going to decide everything. Mm-hmm. And they know best because they're experts.
Before we go any further with the Reason interview, I want to tell you about today's sponsor, Donors Trust, the tax-friendly way to preserve your charitable giving. You listen to Reason podcasts like the Reason interview because you know we offer smart insights that match the way you see the world. But do you do your charitable giving with the same intention in mind? If you use a donor-advised fund from one of the big banks, it's like looking for libertarian insights on NPR. That's why Reason listeners need to know about Donors Trust. Donors Trust is the oldest and largest donor-advised fund made for people who live out with their charitable giving the ideas of free minds and free markets. If you don't know about donor-advised funds, you should. The funds give you a simple tax-advantaged way to easily donate to charities that align with your values, whether it's promoting education freedom, protecting free speech, or just helping people live better lives. The choice is yours. There's lots of providers of donor-advised funds, but Donors Trust is the one that understands you the best. Donors Trust is a great friend of Reason and to all other groups like it. In fact, you've probably seen Donors Trust ads in Reason magazine. So if you're charitable and aren't using a fund, you owe it to yourself to get to know Donors Trust. And if you do have a fund somewhere else, roll it over to Donors Trust and work with people who really understand what you stand for. There isn't time here to go through all the benefits of a donor-advised fund with Donors Trust, from privacy to having extra time to make your donations. So go find out yourself at donorstrust.org/Nick. Watch a short video on how it works and request information to get started. That's donorstrust.org/Nick. You'll be glad you did. That's donorstrust.org/Nick. And now, back to the Reason interview.
So you came into office in 2011, and it seemed like there was a real libertarian insurgency within the Republican Party, but more nationally in discourse. People were tired of continued centralization, government secrecy. Famously, a lot of Bush's activities, and particularly war spending early on, was done in supplemental and emergency appropriations, not really open to, full discussion and whatnot. All of the stuff coming out of the Patriot Act, somebody like, I was going to say Darth Vader, I meant Dick Cheney, kind of saying like, we're in control. But then Obama also promised the most transparent administration ever and plainly did not deliver on that. But that energy pushing back on centralization and government power and government secrecy seems to, that helped bring you and other people like you to Congress, seems to have dissipated. Do you agree with that? And if so, what took that away?
Yeah, I agree with that. When I was running for office, both for State House in 2009, when I was running for that office, and when I got to Congress in 2011, there was a lot of energy behind a sort of a limited government, libertarian-ish republicanism. And I felt like libertarianism was really rising. There was a chance for libertarian ideals to get a lot of traction. And a lot of people who used to be, I guess, more like Bush conservatives were coming around to the libertarian way. So I felt really good about where things were heading. And for the first, I'd say, 3 or 4 years that I was in Congress, I felt like we continued to move in the right direction. I mean, the creation of the Freedom Caucus was kind of a dream of like bringing people together to challenge the leadership. They weren't all libertarians or anything like that. I mean, there were a few who were libertarian leaning, but the idea that a group of Republican members, it wasn't determined that it was going to be only Republicans, but it ended up being Republicans, that Republican members got together and said, hey, we're going to challenge the status quo. We're going to challenge the establishment. That was a kind of a dream that it had come together. And then when Donald Trump came on the scene, I think a lot of that just fell apart because he's such a strong personality and character and had so much of a hold over a lot of the public, right, especially on the Republican side, that it was very hard for my colleagues to be willing to challenge him.
What do you think the essence, there's been a lot of discussion this weekend about the threat of things like national conservatism or Trumpist populism on the right, woke progressivism on the left. Maybe we'll get to that in a second. But what's the essential appeal of Trump? Is it his personality? Is it that he said he could win and he ended up doing that at least once? Is it a cult of personality? Is it the idea he's in charge? What's the core of his appeal, do you think?
Well, I think he's definitely a unique character. Yeah. He has a certain charisma that is probably unmatched in politics. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen someone who campaigns as effectively as he does. It doesn't mean you have to agree with, you know, all of the ethics of what he does or any of that, or the substance. But I think that...
To keep it in Michigan, he's a rock star. He's Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
You may not like what he's doing on the stage, but you can't take your eyes off it.
That's right. He holds court. You know, like when he's out there, people pay attention. And he really understands the essence of campaigning, how to win a campaign. He understands how to effectively go after opponents. Now, again, I'm not saying that all of these things are necessarily ethical or that other people should do the same things, but he really understands how to lead a populist movement.
Yeah. And how important do you think in his appeal is a politics of resentment that, you know, somehow he is going to get back what was taken from you unfairly?
Well, I mean, the whole make America great again. Yeah. There's a whole idea there of someone is destroying your life and I'm going to get it back for you. And that's a very powerful thing to a lot of people. For a lot of people out there, it is more important to get back at others than necessarily to have some kind of vision of how this is all going to work going forward. It's not appealing to me because I understand we live in one country. We have people of all sorts of backgrounds. And if you're going to persuade people, you have to be able to live with them and work with them regardless of your differences. It doesn't mean that you can't be upset, be angry about what some other people are doing or saying, but there has to be an effort to live together here as one country. We have too much in common in this country.
What Michigan was a massive swing state when he won election. You voted to impeach Donald Trump. What went into that calculation, and then what was it? What was the reaction like to that? Because that, you know, that's a profile in courage.
Well, I don't think that's like, you know, I don't think that's my most courageous vote, not even by a long shot.
Naming the post office after your father, or
I didn't name any post offices after my father, to be clear. So I think that the courageous votes are the ones where everyone is against you. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean just like, you know, one party. It's one thing to vote for impeachment and like half the country loves what you did and half the country doesn't like what you did. That's, in my mind, not that challenging or difficult. It's when you take a vote and you know that 99% of the public is going to misconstrue this, misunderstand it, be against it. The vote is going to be something like, 433-1 in the House or something like that. Those are the tough votes. Yeah. Hmm. And there are plenty of those votes out there where you're taking a principled stand and you're doing it to protect people's rights. But it's not the typical narrative.
Is there an example that in your legislative record that you would put forth for that?
Well, I mean, one of the ones I've talked about before is they tried to pass some anti-lynching legislation at the federal level, and everyone's against lynching, obviously. But the legislation itself was bad and would actually harm a lot of people, including harming a lot of Black Americans. So, like, there was this idea that this legislation was good was just, you know, parroted by a lot of people in the media. They didn't read the legislation. And in fact, I complained about it, and it mysteriously did not pass both houses that Congress after I pointed out all the problems with it. It did pass the House of Representatives, did not pass both houses and get signed by the president. And mysteriously, the next Congress, they reintroduced it and rewrote it in a way that took into consideration all of my complaints. And they tried to pass it off like they were just reintroducing the same legislation. And I pointed out, hey, they actually, you know, they actually saw that there was a problem here and then tried to pretend like, oh, we're just passing it again. Those kind of votes are tough because when you take the vote, you know, everyone thinks you're wrong.
Right.
Everyone. And you have to go home and you have to explain it. And those are the ones that are tricky. Back to the impeachment point. Look, I'd impeach every president. let's be clear. Now, I'm not the kind of person who's going to introduce impeachment legislation, you know, over every thing that a president does wrong. When you introduce legislation to impeach a president, you have to have some backing for it. It can't just be, you know, one person saying, let's impeach. For example, I would definitely impeach President Biden over these unconstitutional wars. Mm-hmm. 100%. Mm-hmm. But the idea of introducing impeachment legislation suggests there's other people who will join you. Otherwise, it's just an exercise in futility. Right. You know, you introduce it, it doesn't go anywhere, it just sits there. If we're going to impeach people, there has to be some public backing, which is why I try to make the case all the time for these impeachable offenses, why some legislation should be brought forth. Yeah. But you've got to get the public behind you on that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think that every president should be impeached, every recent president at least.
If Trump populism, national conservatism is, and a politics of resentment is sucking up a lot of energy on the right, how do you feel about, or like, how do we deal with the rise of identity politics and a kind of woke progressivism on the left? Where is that coming from, and what is the best way to combat that?
I think a lot of it is just repackaged socialist ideas, collectivist ideas. The idea of equity, for example, is really like a perversion of the idea of equality. In most respects, when people say equity, they mean the opposite of equality. It means you're going to have the government or some central authority decide what the outcome should be, how much each person should have, rather than some system of equality before the law, where the government is not some kind of arbiter of who deserves what. And when you think about it, there is no way for the government to do this. There's no way for the government to properly assess all of our lives. This is, in many ways, the point of diversity is like we're all so different, and there's no way that a central authority can decide how to manage all that. So for many of the people on the woke left who say they care about diversity, they don't care about diversity if they're talking about equity. These things are in conflict with each other. The idea that you're going to decide that someone is more deserving than another based on some superficial characteristics. As an example, I've talked about this, and I've talked about this earlier in this conversation. My dad came here with nothing as a poor refugee. Yet, in a lot of cases, he might be classified as just a white American. Even though he came here as an extremely poor Palestinian refugee. The New York Times, for example, classifies me as white. They might classify someone else who's Middle Eastern as a person of color.
They actually did, right? With Rashida Tlaib.
So I think a lot of this is just someone is making decisions at the top saying, well, we think this person is more like this or that, and we're going to decide they're more deserving. But they don't know our backgrounds. They don't know anything about us. They don't know who deserves this or who deserves that. And no central authority could figure that out. So the best thing we can do is have a system of equality before the law, where the law treats everyone the same. It doesn't give an advantage to any person over another person. And it may not be fair in some sense to some people. Some people may say, well, that's not fair. You know, some people, instead of having a dad who's a Palestinian refugee, their dad was some, Silicon Valley billionaire. Mm-hmm. Some person might have a dad who was a professor. Another person might have a dad who worked at a fast food restaurant. You don't know what the differences are. The government can't figure all of this out and say, who is more deserving than someone else. So I really think that the woke left, when they push this idea of equity, they're really pushing against diversity. They're saying, we're going to decide, a few people at the top are going to decide who's valuable and who's not valuable. And they're not going to actually take into consideration any of our differences because no central authority could take it into consideration.
You are a libertarian, not an anarchist. You believe there is a role for government, but it should be obviously much more limited. You're also—
Although that's a complicated topic, but I could write a whole book about that.
We would love to read that book. You are also an Orthodox Christian. Could you talk a little bit about how in a world of limited government, a libertarian world, the government wouldn't be doing everything for everybody, but organizations and institutions like the church or other types of intervening, countervailing, mediating institutions would help to fill the gaps that are left by government?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, that's the place for these organizations is to help in society, not to have government deciding it. Again, when you have some central authority deciding it, you are really limiting the opportunities for the public. You're limiting the opportunities for assisting people. You're deciding that a few people are going to make all the decisions rather than having a lot of organizations and a lot of individuals making decisions. When you centralize it all, there are a lot of people who are going to be missed, a lot of people who are going to be ignored. When you let the marketplace work this out, when you let private organizations work this out, there's a lot more opportunity for people who need help to get help. And I think that's really important.
We're running out of time, but I want to ask, to go back to this question of there was a libertarian wave. I like to call it a libertarian moment, which I think we're still living in, but we don't understand. Rhetoric aside.
There's been a pause.
Yeah, okay. What are the best ways to kind of get libertarian ideas and sensibilities in front of young people to really energize the coming, you know, you're a millennial, and Gen Z, like the world is getting young again. And how do we make sure that these people are hearing and understanding and maybe being persuaded by libertarian ideas?
Well, for one thing, we have to meet them where they are. I spend a lot of time, for example, asking my kids, which social media kids use these days.
Exclusively Pornhub, in my experience.
they're in a lot of places that the adults aren't. So we might be on Facebook. I mean, my generation, your generation, other people are on X or Twitter. And there are other people on TikTok. And so, like, you have to meet them where they are. And if they're not on X, and it's still weird calling it X. If they're not on X and you are, well, they're not hearing your message. So that's an issue. And that's something we all have to work on. You know, I'm probably reaching primarily Gen X and millennial people on X. And I'm probably not reaching Gen Z people as well. So, I think we need to work on getting them in those places. I think people who have libertarian instincts, people who want to present libertarianism and have an opportunity, go speak to students at schools. I used to do this as a member of Congress. I used that opportunity as much as I could. When schools would invite me, I'd say yes. I'd be happy to come to the school to speak to the students and take all their questions and be open about being a libertarian. Mm-hmm. Tell them frankly that your philosophy is libertarianism and talk to them about it. I think it's great. A lot of teachers end up surprised. They walk away saying, I've had many teachers walk up to me and say, like, whisper to me, I think I'm a libertarian too, you know, after having the conversation, because they have stereotypes about what it might mean to be a libertarian. And you have the opportunity to change their mind.
Final question. I have seen a lot of chatter. I have actually helped publish a lot of chatter that you may be running for the U.S. Senate from the mediocre state of Michigan. Do you have an announcement?
Go blue.
Yeah. Do you have an announcement that you would like to make?
So as a part of the national championship winning state of Michigan this year, I am exploring a run for Senate. Mm-hmm. The FEC requires me to state that I am not a candidate for Senate, but I am exploring a run for Senate. And if you're interested in checking it out, go to exploratory.justinamash.com. I'm giving it serious thought. I think that there is an opportunity for libertarians this year, and there's an opportunity to win a Republican Senate seat this year. So I'm looking at the Republican primary, and I think this is probably the best shot libertarians have had in a long time in the state of Michigan.
All right. Thank you very much, Justin Amash.
Thanks.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, please go to Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe. Don't miss a single episode. Or make it super easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. And while you're at reason.com/podcasts, sign up for our other podcasts. We're offering more and more every week, it seems. They're great shows. Go to reason.com/podcast and sign up there. Thanks for listening.